I have to go upstairs and record something again, so
quiet
and do not
smash anything
and do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
Hi, you're listening to Pandemic, a new podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Cullum O'Mungoyne, and most days of the week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. The sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat sometimes, as correspondents and I will be recording this, in many cases, on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Friday, May 22nd, and at the time of recording this in the early evening, over 5.1 million people have been recorded as infected with COVID-19 around the world. More than 335,000 people have died. The latest figures for Ireland, as confirmed this evening by the Department of Health, are as follows. 11 more people have died from COVID-19, bringing the overall death toll here to 1,592. 115 more cases have been diagnosed here, bringing the number of confirmed cases to 24,506. In today's episode, we're going to look at what was said about new measures on travelling here announced this evening, and at the ongoing concern about infections in the meat industry. We're also going to have a look at government borrowing. How will it be brought down, as government has indicated, without imposing austerity, as parties to the current government formation talks have pledged? We'll hear shortly from this evening's briefing at the Department of Health. Our correspondent Sinead Crowley was on her way there when I caught up with her earlier. Hey, how are you?
Hi, good.
I hear the turning of notebook pages, Sinead.
You
all set?
Indeed, I have my notes ready to go.
The notes from last night. So what was going on last night at the briefing?
Thursday night is the night where we hear from Professor Philip Nolan, who is the chair of the
Epidemiological, is it?
That's the one, of the modelling advisory group, and he gives the R number of the virus on a Thursday. So positive news last night, it stayed at, you know, it's in or around the 0.5, as we explained then last week. That means two people give it to one person. The theory would be if it stayed at that, it would eventually burn itself out the community. So he also gave us other very positive news in terms of ICU admissions down, general hospital admissions down, number of cases per day trending downwards. Obviously, you know, there's different number of cases every day and different numbers of reporting, but essentially the trend is downwards. The indicators are very good. So that's all very positive. Now, he did go on, however, to say that, first of all, he understands, or what his reckoning is, that fewer than 5% of the population, in fact, possibly even near to 1% of the population, have in fact been exposed to the virus. So what does that say? Well, on the one hand, it means that the efforts made to suppress it have been very successful. However, on the other hand, it means there's no immunity out there. His reading is that there are fewer than, you know, around 1% of people have had it, which means that even if having the virus does give you immunity, then there certainly isn't anything like mass immunity or herd immunity. And their worry from last night's briefing seems to be that if this R number goes up at all, then we could be back in a case of pressure. So, for example, if he said if it went up to 1.2, you could have back at a situation where you had 400, 500, even 600 cases a day, which is obviously the place we were at a while ago. If there was a 1.6 R number, then it would be a sharp rise. If there was 1.8, you could see 800 cases per day. And that's where you're coming into back into the pressure on the health service, the pressure on the ICU beds and so on. And that's when you're talking about, you know, possible restrictions. So even though it all looks very positive, there was still the strong message coming from the health briefing that you can't get complacent and that you have to keep going with your distancing and everything else.
Our colleague Mark Coughlan from Primetime also had an interesting number that he winkled out of the Department of Health.
He did. His figures show that, I think, as of earlier this week, less than 2,000 people in the country have the virus at the moment. Obviously, you have people who had it and who recovered and people who were diagnosed and so on. But less than 2,000 actually have it. So that, I suppose, would tie in with what Professor Nolan said, which is where he reckons that only around 1%, maybe 2% have actually been exposed to it. So those figures, again, they're quite low. Again, they show, yes, great success in containing it, great success in suppressing it. But I suppose they're then keeping an eye on what would happen if it was to go up or if it was to spread more freely. And you would imagine, meeting today, you would imagine that these are among the things they discuss at method level. Another interesting thing from Professor Nolan last night, I suppose it makes sense, but it's worth remembering, is that all of these figures we hear relate to incidences of a number of days ago. So when he's talking about, you know, diagnosis and it's spreading in the community, that relates to some time ago. So we're in a situation where it is now Friday. The restrictions were lifted last Monday, the 18th. It's next week, really, that you're going to be looking for figures to see, is the spread increasing or are we still on track?
And all of this, the numbers for Ireland presuppose that we're only dealing with Ireland almost as a sealed container. There will be some announcement, it's expected later on this, on what kind of firming up of the quarantine measures there might be coming into Irish ports and airports.
Yeah, this has been discussed, obviously, and it's been part of the whole issue all the way along. But it is expected today that there will be an announcement following Cabinet on official quarantine measures. And it has been suggested that these would include, if you came into the country, you'd have to fill in a form and you would have to give an address where you were going to be in quarantine for 14 days. Now, we haven't heard from the minister yet. We have to wait and see, for example, will this be a legal document or, you know, will it be advisory or what form, if you'll excuse the pun, what form the form will take. But certainly the supposition appears to be that there will be this element of waiting 14 days when you come into the country, and that obviously will have massive implications both for people coming into the country, the tourist industry, for example. You can assume nobody's going to come on holiday if they then have to spend 14 days in the country in quarantine before they start their holiday. Likewise, people from here going abroad aren't going to go if they think they have to spend 14 days in isolation on their way back. You know, it will have an impact, so we're waiting to see what those measures are. Not dissimilar to measures employed in other parts of the world, you know, Britain introducing similar as well, although not, I believe, in relation to Ireland. So that's that, you know, common travel policy might be there, but we are waiting to hear the details of our own government's announcement later.
Yeah, Britain seems to be location specific, that even British people coming back from holidays from outside of Britain or Ireland in the common travel area, that people coming outside from there would be expected to quarantine. So,
and I mean, I expect it will be similar here. Yeah, anybody coming into the country. So as I say, it affects both Irish people who want to travel and non-Irish people who want to come back in.
Thanks, Sinead. No, good luck. See you. Bye-bye. Bye. Now, in that briefing, as we expected to hear, as you've just heard from Sinead, we heard from the Minister for Health on what measures would be taken to get information from travellers.
From next week, passengers arriving into Ireland from overseas will be legally required to present a completed public health passenger locator form. Putting this form on a mandatory footing will facilitate a system of follow-up checks to make sure that people who travel to this country, wherever they come from, are staying where they said that they would. And really importantly, this will help ensure swift contact tracing if there is to be a confirmed case. So if we were to see a confirmed case of COVID-19 in our country, we will now have a lot of information and data that would help us very quickly move to find anybody who may have been impacted. I think that's so important in terms of making sure we keep on top of any potential risk of an imported case.
Simon Harris also fielded a number of follow-up questions. The questions themselves were off mic, so I've bundled together a number of the answers, but it's clear what he's answering here.
So you have to provide an address as to where you intend to stay for the next 14 days, because that's what I'm concerned about, is the 14-day incubation period. You will need to provide an address. Your form will be emailed to you in advance of coming to the country. So people will have this form, they will know about it. There will be advertising campaigns run in Ireland in relation to Irish people leaving and returning. At the moment, we haven't taken a decision in relation to a mandatory facility. But that is one of that, and the issue of making self-isolation mandatory are two of the issues that I'll be working cross-government on in the coming weeks. It's really important we align with Northern Ireland, and I suppose that's in answer to the last question. I mean, that is a key priority for us already. Myself and the Taoiseach have been engaged in discussions, and we had a meeting last week with the Northern Ireland Secretary of State, the First Minister, Deputy First Minister, and my counterpart, the Northern Ireland Health Minister, and we'll be engaging further to try and ensure that we align as much as possible, and also obviously aligning on an east-west basis as well. I should say this today, though, just the number of people travelling at the moment is very low, and in fact the overwhelming number of people travelling into our country are Irish people returning home. But this is an issue that I expect as the world begins to open up and open up at different speeds and different paces, that you could see more and more travel. So I think it could become, the risk of imported cases, I think, becomes more significant as the world begins to open back up. So the penalty is the same as the penalty in general in the primary legislation of, from my memory, I think it's a up to 2,500 euro fine and up to a 6 month imprisonment. And they're the penalties set out, I think, in the primary legislation. Now, again, let me just say this. Today, the form is on an administrative basis. The overwhelming number of people are filling it out. Our success will continue to be on working with people. And I actually think, from talking to lots of people across this country, I think people want to know that these measures are in place. If they're working really hard and sacrificing so much, they want to know that we're making sure that anybody coming into the country, including Irish people returning, that we're all aware of our obligations. So the idea that you'll now meet someone in an airport in a position of authority, that you'll have to hand them over your form saying, this is my name, this is where I'm staying, this is how you contact me, and also that you'd be given information on self-isolation and why you need to do that, I think is an extra layer of protection. Yes, people can continue to travel, obviously, between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and there'll only be a requirement on people moving and travelling through the jurisdiction onto the north to fill out a small piece of the form. But I am eager, and I don't wish to get ahead of myself, but I am eager to make sure we align as closely as possible with the UK and Ireland in relation to the common travel area. Like, so there's work ongoing in relation to that.
Listener, take a moment to pause now and breathe. Listen to the rain beat against my window and then breathe again. Because our agriculture and consumer affairs correspondent Fran McNulty has some meditations on meat to bring to us.
How are you doing?
How's it going? Are you well?
Good, come.
The difference between Pilates and Zumba, Fran, was one of the interesting things I found out from your column today. We might get into that in a moment. It's in the context of the meat industry and the outbreak of infection that's been there. The last time we talked about it, you were just back from a meat processing facility last week. What have we learned in the last week in terms of the infections?
Well, quite a staggering figure was dropped this week. 328 additional cases in meat plants. That's in 1 week and a total of 16 clusters. And numbers like that are concerning. You know, you're talking about 828 cases overall. Now, the meat industry came out and were very quick and keen to make the point in Morning Ireland during the week. Up to 65% of people who had COVID in the meat industry have recovered and are now back at work. And that's something that Michael Creed, the Minister for Agriculture, and Heather Humphreys repeated numerous times in the Dáil during their two-hour question session on COVID-19 in meat plants this week. But there is a picture emerging of outbreaks in plants which are concerning, about workforces being depleted, about production being affected. And no matter what anybody says, the reality is this: there is a very significant problem with COVID-19 in meat plants.
Just to go back to that interview that you were just referencing there with Meat Industry Ireland, there was a downplaying of the extent of the problem. There was almost an element of nothing to see here to it.
Yeah, and the industry has been doing that from the get-go. It's fair to say that Minister Creed and government sources are doing the same as well. Minister Creed talking constantly about how his officials are telling him that industry and management are cooperating fully with the HSE outbreak teams where there is an incident, and that everything is fine. Yet you see, like, 328 cases in 1 week, it is patently obvious everything is not fine. It is also patently obvious that, you know, perhaps measures were put in place too late. Maybe they're getting it under control now. But there are and have been issues in the meat sector with how this has been handled. There are accounts from workers that they weren't given PPE. We're still hearing accounts from workers as late as the last 2 hours. I've been speaking to somebody saying that the facility they're working in, social distancing is an issue. And I referenced this in the piece I did for Online Today, Colm. Like, social distancing in meat factories is very difficult. There is no doubt about it. It presents an issue in the same way as construction and some other trades. It's just really hard to achieve. It doesn't mean that when a worker puts their hand up and says, I'm not comfortable here, it shouldn't be dealt with properly, as it would in any other workplace.
Sorry, I interrupted you there. You were about to mention the Health and Safety Authority, because the next question I was going to ask you was, in terms of the independent inspection ability of the state in the form of the Health and Safety Authority, do they think it's fine, or have they even been in deep enough to find out if it's fine?
Here's where there's a lack of clarity. I spoke last week to the HSA about this and wanted to know how many meat plants or agri-food facilities they had inspected. They said they didn't know. Then somebody from the HSA admitted in the Oireachtas in the last week that no meat plants were visited. And last night, Heather Humphreys confirmed in Leinster House during that Dáil session that the HSA had carried out 240 workplace inspections, I think in the last week or week and a half, which is a phenomenal number of inspections in a short period of time. But she couldn't say how many of them were meat plants. And she and Michael Creed were asked repeatedly by TDs in the House how many meat plants were examined. And eventually, in a very tetchy exchange, the minister said, "I don't know. It's confidential. They don't tell me how many. That's confidential. It's between them and between the meat plants, and that's the way the system works."
Right, because Tom Parlin, the head of the Construction Industry Federation, was saying today that he knew that dozens had been carried out on building sites. So it appears he seems to be more in the know, or at least more willing to share a ballpark
figure.
Well,
I suppose Tom Parlin would have the same role for construction as Meat Industry Ireland would for the meat factories. And one is just more communicative than the other. And that's the issue. Now, Heather Humphreys did confirm last night that some meat plants were inspected. And we know that none of them have been closed down, bar one that voluntarily closed down. But, Colm, if there wasn't a problem in the meat industry, the HSE put in place a national outbreak team. If there wasn't a problem, that team would not have carried out a review, a full report into outbreaks of COVID-19 in meat plants. Like, they have done that. The Public Health Emergency Team are considering that, or have considered that today. Like, if there wasn't a problem, actions like that simply wouldn't happen.
So you wrote an extensive piece on the website today, and an issue you touched on last week was the availability of information on this. Questions are being asked on the Dáil. As you said, it became quite tetchy. The issue of transparency looms very large in this.
It does. It's a significant problem. Here are the things we don't know, right? We don't know how many plants were inspected by the Health and Safety Authority. We don't know how many plants have had very serious outbreaks. We just know this broad number of 16 clusters. The minister admitted himself last night that his department isn't informed of cases in meat plants. It's dealt with through the Department of Health. The meat industry claims, this migrant worker issue has been consistently raised because a lot of workers in the sector are migrants. They have living conditions, certain pay levels, and that presents issues in how they share accommodation.
Which was being downplayed by Meat Industry Ireland in an interview
entirely
earlier this week.
Cormac Healy made a claim in Morning Ireland that just 20% of the workforce is migrant labour. Duncan Smith from Labour in the Dáil last night claimed that SIPTU had told him it was up on 75 to 90%. So where is the truth of the matter? What is the reality?
Is it 20% from outside the EU area and a significant number of migrant labour from inside the EU area, but obviously working on EU conditions and therefore not requiring visas? Is this the discrepancy? Or again, is this another unknown?
That could be. Or would you consider a migrant to be a Lithuanian man who came here 9 years ago to work and continues to work here in a meat plant? Do you consider him to be migrant labour? That might be the argument that's used. Well, under the very definition of a migrant, yes, you would, because he's travelled for work. It's a matter of interpretation. So you've all these, in a way, Colm, they're interesting arguments and worthy discussion points, but all the while you have a workforce which feels vulnerable and feels exposed and feels under pressure and feels that they need to turn up for work because they work under permit if they're from outside the EU. That permit is attached to your employer, and therefore, if things aren't going well with your employer, your legal status here faces a problem. And that's why there is a vulnerability to these workers.
Fran, there's a certain amount of issues that are very hard to deal with in the meat industry, and you laid them out in the piece. You touched on some of them last week as well. That makes it a particularly vulnerable sector. Like, in brief, why is there such a problem in the meat industry that's seen not only in Ireland, but also internationally?
Yeah, it's a global issue. A few things. Firstly, there is the proximity issue, the need for people to work together. Meat factories, and there is a lot of labour. There are a lot of people. The difference with the dairy industry is in dairy, you need less people in processing plants. You need a lot of people in meat plants. That's just the way it works. And then there's the issue as well of the temperature in the plants, actually. There is cold air, and that helps the virus survive. That is an issue too. And very often some of these facilities, they're quite congested. So whilst you may have social distancing on certain lines, you may stagger your lunch breaks, you may stagger start times, they're all piling in the same narrow corridors. They're using the same locker rooms, the same canteens, the same toilets. And when you have that volume of people, that presents an issue. Then there is a question mark over social distancing outside of the workplace as well. Like one company writing to workers to tell them they had been informed by the guards they weren't socially distancing outside. Is that a language barrier issue? Is the information that these workers have been given, are they understanding it fully? Is it been explained to them? There have been questions which have arisen about that. And then you get into the science side of it. And that's where the Zumba Pilates thing you refer to comes
yes,
from.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
You know, it is, you know, it's quite surprising. But when you begin to research this, there is a significant body of research which suggests that the volume at which you speak, we'll come to Zumba in a minute, but the volume at which you speak determines the amount of particles you expel. So somebody who speaks louder or tends to shout a lot expels more particles.
So if you're in a noisy factory and you have to raise your voice,
you're shouting.
You're spitting.
You're spitting and you're shouting more, and it's a noisy workplace, and meat plants are very noisy. I mean, the air circulation systems alone are noisy. Then the belts going and carcasses banging, bones, boxes. It's a really noisy place. So that's one theory, that because people are shouting more, speaking louder, it's spreading more. Then remember, you have that cold air filtration system. It's maintaining the virus more. Then there's the issue, the Zumba issue.
Right.
There is also research say that if you're people who breathe heavier, tend to spread it more. So there was a case in South Korea of well over 50 clusters of COVID-19 from Zumba classes.
And for anybody who doesn't know, it's a vigorous form of dance exercise done communally. Not that I need to explain this to you.
Oh, no. To be honest, I've only ever seen it, I have to testify. But people shouting, or people jumping, loud music, you know, expelling a lot of energy. We haven't seen any similar outbreaks in Pilates classes, which are far more relaxed and more zen. So all of that, I mean, when you think about it, in many respects, the meat industry, it has everything in terms of the research that we know as to why it would spread. The other very interesting case with that thing of how loud people speak, there was one fascinating case in Washington where one person turned up at choir practice. One person thought they had a cold. They actually had COVID-19. And from that one rehearsal, more than 50 people contracted the virus and two of them died. So think about a choir, you're singing, it's loud. So the meat industry has all of that coming together. So it's much more than just migrant workers being piled on top of each other and bad bosses that don't observe social distancing. Actually, there are other scientific reasons around it. It's not simple, but it's probably a reason that it needs to be looked at. And it is an essential service. We all need food. So quite how they marry everything up remains to be seen.
All right. Okay. Well, I think we'll probably, given that there are so many unknowns in it, we'll probably be checking in with you possibly next week or certainly soon anyway.
Pleasure.
All right. Cheers, Fran. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Don.
Finally today, we heard the Minister for Finance and the Taoiseach expressing concerns about the level of debt the country is accruing. Let's hear first from the Taoiseach in the Dáil yesterday.
We should not make the mistake of assuming that being able to borrow cheaply now means we'll be able to borrow cheaply in 6 months or years' time. The world has changed so much in the last 6 months, and we'd be naive to think that it couldn't change again, and quickly. If conditions do change, the countries with the biggest deficits and the largest debts will be the first to feel the ill wind.
And today, the Minister for Finance, Pascal Donoghue, was laying out the same concerns at the Institute of International and European Affairs.
I just want to emphasise, however, that what is in place at the moment, I do not believe is going to become a normal. And when that normal changes, if you have a national debt of well in excess of 200 billion euro, a minute change in those interest rates can have a very significant effect on the day-to-day operation of the Irish state.
Now, others in opposition disagree with that stance, as do a number of economists and commentators. I've been looking at all this with our economics correspondent, Robert Short. Hi, Robert.
Colm, how are you?
I'm not too bad. Exciting times for the economics correspondent. You find yourself looking at a real live economics debate. Tell us what this debate is. Tell us what's going on.
Well, I guess it's all because of COVID that we're discussing this.
And essentially what we're talking about here is what is the sustainable level of debt for an economy like Ireland, and indeed, I suppose, many other economies, but particularly Ireland. How much debt can we sustain in the face of COVID? What's the right amount for us to borrow? How much can we borrow? Should we borrow? All of this is now coming very much to the fore because the economy, as we know, has been clobbered by COVID-19. It's precipitated an economic crisis. We are probably right now going through the depths of a recession, and it's likely to last for some time to come. And I suppose the big question is just how long will it last? And all of the things that the government has put in place to help people get through that, like the COVID pandemic payments, the temporary worker scheme and so on, has led to an explosion in public spending. And right now, in fact, just this afternoon, the Minister for Finance, Pascal Donoghue, confirmed that we were now probably in the upper reaches of what they had laid out last month in terms of the deficit for this year. So it's
in excess of about 30 billion, is it?
It's going towards 30 billion euro.
30 billion euro.
Now, just to put that in context, they had been expecting to run a surplus this year of about 2.5 billion euros. So they've gone in the opposite direction and to come up with a deficit of 30 billion euro. It's quite a turnaround in the public finances.
And that is all very bad news. However, on the upside, the money we are borrowing to run that kind of a deficit is, relatively speaking, dirt cheap in terms of the interest rate and the servicing of that debt.
Yeah, absolutely. So we just saw indeed this week, just yesterday, the NTMA, which manages our debt, they managed to raise short-term money, which they call treasury bills, 750 million euro from now until October, to be repaid back in October, at a negative interest rate of minus 0.43%. What's that?
People are paying for a haircut, basically.
Basically people are paying us to loan us money. Now, that may sound crazy, but basically the topsy-turvy world that we're living in now is investors with huge amounts of money, of cash, have a problem about where to put it. So there's a glut of savings out there, if you like, and they'll get charged if they leave it on deposit with commercial banks. The commercial banks, in turn, will get charged by the ECB if they park it there overnight. And all of this is to try to stimulate money to get out there into the economy. So when someone like the Irish government comes around and says, I'd like to borrow some money and I promise I'll give it back to you in October, well, then they're probably going to end up paying slightly less to give it to us than they would end up having to pay their bank to hold on to their money. So that's the sort of topsy-turvy world we're in right now, because the ECB, the European Central Bank, has flooded the financial markets with so much money that the price of money, if you like, the rate that's charged to loan money, is so incredibly low now. And the reason it's low is they're trying to give as much support as possible to Eurozone governments to borrow to get themselves over the economic crisis that has been precipitated by COVID-19.
Right. And one of the jobs of the European Central Bank is to keep an eye on inflation. And one of the ways that it keeps an eye on inflation or tries to control inflation is that it raises the interest rate when it looks like inflation is getting out of control. Now, when the economy is on the floor, there's little danger of inflation, so it doesn't seem that there's much prospect of interest rates changing any time in the near future. So why is the Irish government now saying that we really have to be super careful about borrowing because interest rates might be higher in 6 months' time? It seems unlikely.
Yeah, you're correct to point out the thing about inflation. Inflation is kind of like a thermometer for the economy. So when it's raging, inflation is high, it probably means that the economy is overheating and it needs to be sort of brought back under control. So you increase interest rates. When inflation is too low, it's usually an indicator, as you put it, that the economy is on the floor. So you need to cut rates to get things moving again. So we're in a very strange place right now. And we have been actually, even before we came to COVID-19, where interest rates have been low for a long time. And yet there has not been as much activity in the Eurozone economy, let's take it just for a moment, than the ECB would like to see. And they've sort of made the point for quite some time now that monetary policy, which is the setting of interest rates and controlling money supply, that has kind of reached its limits. I've been calling for quite some time now for governments to put their hands in their pockets and to stimulate the economy directly through fiscal policy, the spending of government money. Now, the problem that the Irish government is pointing to, that the Minister for Finance and the Taoiseach both pointed to on several occasions this week, is it's all well and good saying we can borrow like billio right now because the interest rates are so low, but we came into this crisis already with a fairly significant level of debt, and that just because we can borrow at very low rates now, when it comes to that debt being rolled over or repaid or so on, that the interest rates down the road may not look as good as they are now.
Sure.
I don't think we're talking about 6 months down the road. They're talking about possibly 5 years down the road or whatever, because an awful lot of things go into how the markets price in debt. And what looks favorable now may not be favorable in 5 years' time. And then a lot of it will depend on, you know, what you use to spend, what you use that money for. And essentially how markets price the money they loan to governments is how they assess their chances of getting that money back. And how they get their money back is if that economy, the Irish economy, continues to grow. And I suppose one of the key points that both the Taoiseach and the Minister for Finance were making this week was that the recovery may not be as easy to achieve as, say, the recovery off the back of the financial crisis, where pharmaceuticals took off, there was a whole new wave of investment from digital companies and so on. And then there was the other thing that they were pointing to, was that, you know, large parts of the economy that have been doing very well up to now, you know, it may be very different in a post-COVID environment. So whether that's aviation or whatever it happens to be, it may not be as vibrant as they were prior to COVID-19. So they're basically being cautious.
That would all be fine, except for entering into these government formation talks with Fianna Fáil. Both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael said there will be no austerity coming into the future. So how do you tackle, when you say there is no free money and you need to reduce borrowing and you're not necessarily confident that growth will get you out of the hole, how do you marry up all of those things and still sustain the idea that some form of cuts in spending and the like won't happen?
Well, I guess there's no simple answer to that. I mean,
I suppose it was a long question, so there was never going to be a simple answer to it, but I think you know what I'm driving at.
So look, the question of austerity and, you know, can we do all of this borrowing without austerity down the road? And you got to define austerity, right? And you know, the argument is, well, look, if the economy grows sufficiently, then we won't have to increase taxes to pay back this and all the rest of it. You know, if you're going to get the public finances in order, then the first thing you've got to do is to get your deficit under control. So the sort of yearly overdraft, if you like, on your spending that you're running up, that has to be financed by borrowing. So at some point, when the economy starts picking up again, the amount of excess spending over what the government's taking in taxes will have to be curtailed. Now, whether that translates into fewer business supports because businesses are doing okay again in a year's time or so on, or whether that translates into austerity-like cuts in spending that people begin to feel, like cutbacks in health expenditure, for example, from their current, you know, enhanced levels that we've seen through COVID-19. Until you see that, you can't answer the question as to, you know, getting the public finances back into line equals austerity. So they're all choices. There are a range of choices that'll have to be made down the road when it comes to the point where the government goes, right, you know what, the economy's beginning to pick up again, we can start cutting back on our spending that we've been using to get the economy back in line again. But if I could just get back to kind of the fundamental point, which is, you know, the counter argument to, well, be cautious on, you know, what you borrow. The counter argument to that is that unless you borrow and invest and take advantage of this era of cheap money, then the damage that will be done to the economy while companies are shuttered up and so on, that you will not be able to undo that damage, that it'll be much more difficult to go back and start all those companies again rather than borrowing to kind of sustain them through these tough times. Now, the government's gone some way to doing that with the temporary wage subsidy scheme, but it's all a question of balance.
Right.
And one thing the government hasn't indicated, and they're very unlikely to indicate this, is at what stage are they going to feel uncomfortable with the level of borrowing, the level of deficit? At what stage are they going to sit around the cabinet table and go, you know what, that's one bailout too many. Okay.
Good luck.
Well, talk to you again.
Talk Good to luck. You. Bye-bye. Cheers, bye. And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back on Monday with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rt.ie. That's colm.omongain@rt.ie. And thanks to anyone who's already gotten in touch. You can also contact me on Twitter at @colmomongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this regularly. Reviews are welcome. Nice reviews are even more welcome. But until Monday, have a good weekend. Slán, keep safe.